Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday, the 5th of March. Very nice to have you with us for our discussion, and we welcome you to be a part of it. All you have to do is write to us. It's panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And why should we be the only ones having fun? No, you can have the fun too and sound off on what you make of what's happening in the world today. Panel at WAMC.org. Let me introduce everybody to you and we'll get started. Sarah Rogerson is with us. She is very nice, filling in for Libby, who is off this week. But we thank you very much. Sarah Rogerson was with us yesterday. With us today, Albany Law School professor who directs the Immigration Law Clinic. Thank you very much for being here.
I'll do my best.
Yes. Well, you always do. And we thank you for being here. J.P. Miller, thank you for being here. J.P. is the man behind the Empire Report. He is the Empire Report. And how are things going in that venue?
Things are great. How about you?
Well, I'm fine, thank you.
Good.
Yeah. I think we're doing okay. And it's only 78 seconds into the show, but it's still to be determined.
It's going great.
Mike Spain is here, and Mike is a Tuesday regular, of course. We were lucky to have him yesterday, and he is the newly retired Times Union Associate Editor. Good morning, sir.
That's getting old, too. You know, that's been
I know, it's still a couple months now, but you're, you know.
In that new kind of netherland of recently retired.
Can we call you emeritus? Is that?
No. I'm not Ira Fussfeld.
Okay.
That's interesting, you know.
Because that's a great phrase.
It is, but not everybody gets it.
Yeah.
Now, I was at New Paltz for over 40 years.
Yeah.
But I can't be emeritus there.
Why not?
Because the last year, I was entirely at SUNY, and they have a rule. You have to retire from New Paltz to be there. I've always resented that.
It's a stupid rule.
It is a real stupid rule.
If only you had the governor at your fingertips to talk to, it should change that.
Right. So now I'm emeritus. Now I'm emeritus at Albany, which is fine. I liked Albany, but, you know, New Paltz is where my heart is.
Yeah, that's where you spent all those years.
I'm happy to be here.
Yes, well, thank you very
much. I don't want to grab
emeritus or otherwise.
Thank you very much. Because I also played with the word long time associate editor in that, but Alan Chartok is with us. He is he's an emeritus professor of political communication at the University at Albany.
All right.
Good morning, everybody. Okay, let's get started and talk about what's going on. So I have to be honest with you. I know there's a lot of stories that are more pressing than this, but this Canadian thing, what happened to Justin Trudeau? I mean, if you were a betting man and you said that Trump would outlast Trudeau, I mean, who thought that could happen?
I would lose all the money.
All the money in the world. And not to mention all those people who move there seeking solace. My goodness. Well, we'll get to that situation, but it is something. Anyway, let's talk about the House Democrats demanding documents from more than 80 people, 81 to be exact, and institutions affiliated with Trump. Gerald Nadler, the Democrat from New York, who also happens to be the House Judiciary Committee chairman, announced that this is a critical time for our nation and we have a responsibility to investigate these matters and hold hearings. So the list is long and it is very complete. It includes family members to the president. It includes organizations such as the National Rifle Organization, even Cambridge Analytica. It also includes the Inauguration Committee. There is a lot here, and they are seeking this information. While all of this is going on, the White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders criticized the probe in a statement saying, "Today, Chairman Nadler opened up a disgraceful and abusive investigation into tired, false allegations already investigated by the special counsel and committees in both chambers of Congress." The president responded with two words, "No collusion."
Those are the only two words he has left.
I think that's it. I don't know how they really fit in, but okay.
It's not really just alleging collusion. It's looking into the possibility that he may have promised people, that they would, basically get pardons if they cooperated with him and didn't cooperate with investigators. It also gets into corruption and obstruction of justice of the investigations and abuse of power. So okay, no collusion, maybe. We'll find out when Mueller comes out with his report. But there's a whole lot of other stuff that's not very good.
Well, I find it very interesting that Nadler, who I've known about for a long, long time, is doing this because he may have his doubts as to what Mueller is going to come up with. And this may, in fact, redouble all of this. So when the liar Cohen testified before Congress, he made it plain that he knew of an investigation going on in the Southern District, but he didn't tell us what it was, which is sort of interesting, too.
I think that that has to do with a lot of the timing of what Nadler did. You saw Nadler on Stephanopoulos this weekend say, you know, even if Mueller exonerates the president from collusion, there is evidence of multiple crimes, including potential obstruction of justice, that we need to investigate. Michael Cohen gave riveting testimony, obviously, detailing a lot of what Trump did both before and while in office. And so I think that Nadler wanted to get ahead of the Mueller report by issuing this stuff now.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yep.
The president said yesterday, I cooperate all the time with everybody. And I think when you think of a cooperator, you think of President
Trump. I'm the great cooperator.
The great cooperator. I know this is a somewhat of a tangent, but the strangest story I've heard on NPR in a really long time was the one from about a half hour ago.
Oh, I heard that.
About this is where we've come in our journalism and in our politics. The story was about people who are in their 90s, have fatal illnesses and don't want to die before they find out what's in the Mueller report. That was the news story.
That is so cool.
Well, journalistically, I questioned whether, you know, it's like one of these things where you have two anecdotes and you turn it into
a... where's this going to go?
But apparently, somebody at the Brookings Institute heard about these two cases.
And it went viral.
And he tweeted it, and people started saying, and my father, my mother, they want to know, they want to know. They're on their deathbed, and they're desperate to know what's in the Mueller report.
I mean, forget about, like, their wives, their spouses, their children. No, they just want to know what's going on in the Mueller report
out. Tell me what's in the Mueller report. Now, maybe in the next life, they'll get to see it before we do.
I mean, in some families, cable news pays more attention to you than your own family.
It's a very good point, Sarah. So. It's a very, very good point. So with this investigation, does another investigation get us anywhere, though? I mean, I don't know. Is it just going to be another thing that's kind of taking up a lot of time?
Oh, I think, Joe, this is deadly serious. And the reason it is because this is the group of people who are going to have to impeach him. Therefore, this is the material that is going to be used in that non-judicial process. This is, definitional by what they say it is. It doesn't have to be anything other than, you know, that they were... We keep hearing that the president has ignored all the norms of politics.
Right.
Well, you see, here, when you ignore norms of politics, it can be impeachable as opposed to indictable.
You're suggesting that he may never be convicted of a crime, but he could still be impeached and removed from office.
Absolutely.
And this Democratic House doesn't want to be the House that passed on that.
Well, yeah, and of course, we have a Senate that is not going to be helpful. And to this day, we don't think that there's enough backbone throughout the entire Senate to convict him of anything, including, as he once said, shooting somebody on Fifth Avenue. Mm.
And I think the House is effectively right now moving the goalposts. Trump has kind of set the goalposts as no collusion with Russia. Well, that's not the only goalpost for impeaching a president, that they didn't collude with Russia to steal the election. And so you see Cohen's testimony. A lot of times negative stories kind of help Trump in a way. The Cohen testimony did not help Trump in any way. It was someone who's worked with him for 10 years detailing exactly how he operates, and they're going to bring up other people other than Cohen that are going to do more damage to this presidency. And the Republican congressmen were, I think, pretty atrocious in how they treated that witness, and I think that you'll see, hopefully next time, Republican congressmen asking more normalized questions about what really the president has done and is doing, and wait till they bring up more witnesses. That was only really their first big witness.
Right? That's doubtful, isn't it? Because how do you do that without implicating the president that you're trying to in some way protect to protect yourself?
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see
financial guy at Trump organization.
Now Weisselberg has apparently got the keys to the kingdom and knows where the bodies are buried. And he's going to get asked direct questions. And then you have to put yourself in his head, right, as you did with Cohn and all the other guys. And that is to say, does anybody really want to go to prison? And by now, he knows, Trump knows that he's in such trouble that he can't start pardoning people. If he pardons people now, I think that's his end. I think that is the end.
And this hits home, too, because they also, one of the 81 letters went to Donald Jr. and another one went to Eric Trump. And that is hitting very close. And that's the kind of thing that will get the president's ire up. And when you're angry, perhaps you'll flub it even more. You know.
What do we know? What documents they asked for from all these 81 people? What they need to turn over?
It's described as massive, massive scope.
Like they're asking for a data dump, right?
They're looking for everything.
Would you send us every email you've ever written?
Right, communications, communications. But don't you think, though, that there, one strategy could be just to let this drip, drip, drip right through the primary season, right into the general election in 2020?
Definitely.
No, it's all about 2020.
Yep.
And it has been from the very beginning. I mean, there are those people who suspect... far be it from me to be one of those, quote, those people. But there are those people who really suspect that the Democrats don't want to impeach him because they want the 2020 election.
Yep. And they want to keep this theater of Republicans losing their minds over the smallest details. All it takes is a couple of slip-ups on these national stages in order for you to lose your primary as well. So they're just teeing up all kinds of losses, potentially.
I can tell you one thing about Nadler. He's not a guy to fool with.
Yeah.
Well, he sees this as his heritage to this country. I guarantee it.
I also think that he is an effective communicator he does not seem like what the Republicans might characterize a wild-eyed liberal going after the president. He seems very judicious in his statements. He does not say he wants to impeach the president yet, but he wants to investigate this, and this is the Congress's duty to investigate the president. And I've been impressed. I saw him on Stephanopoulos on Sunday, and he was on Rachel Maddow last night. I think he's a very good spokesman for this investigation.
You can only imagine what the Trump forces are doing to find out if anybody has done anything wrong. You know, Nadler or any of these other guys. I am sure everybody's hard at work at that.
Yeah. Opposition research, right? But I mean, I think they've already been through a few rounds of that. So I think any skeletons that they have in their closet are either well hid or managed somehow.
Well, there's no individual on God's earth who hasn't committed some act that they would perhaps not like.
Speak for yourself, Alan.
Yeah, I am.
I was kind of disappointed that the Republicans didn't
Your
have...
Your earth may vary. Yes.
I was surprised that the Republican members of Congress didn't have opposition research on Cohen. They basically said, you're a liar, and that's it. And so I would be...
It's about competence, you mean.
Yes. To think that the White House could orchestrate that... gives them, you're giving them the benefit of some type of confidence and a competence. And I'm not sure that they have that smooth of a political operation that we might all think they do to orchestrate opposition research on their opponents.
Well, there's an interesting New York or even Albany connection to the 80 documents or the 80 letters that went out. A couple of people who were involved in New York Republican politics, Michael Caputo of Buffalo, who has to be, humorously described as the brains behind Carl Baladino's 2010 gubernatorial run. That sounds like an oxymoron. But anyway, he's been the recipient of a letter, and then kind of a kooky comedian and lobbyist for marijuana legalization, Randy Credico, are also among those getting the letters. So, you know, we're kind of watching it from the Albany perspective.
And you do have to wonder, you assume that they have enough information to know who they want, right? I mean, that they have enough of a map that they're following?
I guess so, but if it's a big enough net, you're bound to get something.
We received a letter just now, Joe, not jumping ahead, which basically said they're all going to plead the fifth. Well, we have a lawyer with us who may be able to be helpful. But basically, my feeling is what they do is somebody, in order to prevent somebody from pleading the fifth, you give them immunity. And they come before you, you say, okay, you don't have to plead the fifth. We'll give you immunity. We won't prosecute. And that, of course, takes care of that.
Right, because the fifth is a protection against self-incrimination, right. Statements that you would make that would result in a prosecution of you personally. So, yeah, either immunity or some other cover. Right.
Like what?
They could say, I mean, because I'm not sure that they have the power to grant immunity. They would have to work with prosecutors.
Well, I think if you go back to McCarthy and HUAC hearings and stuff, that's the way they did it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the most effective way to do it. Yeah.
There's also, when you hear the term 81 names, you think, wow, well, they really threw everybody in there. But when you actually read the 81 names, you think, well, there's probably another 81 that they could go after next.
And they've said so. And JP, they've said so. They said this is just the beginning.
Which is, yeah, that's amazing. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation, and we'll welcome your input as well. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org, and then we'll move on to some other subjects. We do want to get into some of the GOP defections regarding the emergency declaration, as well as talk about what's happening on the border with emergency migrations. We will talk about all of that and include your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll be right back after this short break. Listening to the music of Tab Benoit, who is playing Iron Horse Music Hall in Northampton on Wednesday, otherwise known as tomorrow. And you can find out more by going to IHEG.com, IHEG.com, to find out more Tab Benoit. And we have some letters, Alan. We'll go to those, and then we'll move on.
Okay, Chief, I'll start reading. You tell me when to stop. Linda said, only 71? Good morning, panel. I had not heard the NPR report about the 90-year-olds, but I can tell you that I've said many times, please, Lord, let me live long enough to see the end of the Trump nightmare. And I'm only 71, and I can't believe I said only. Your program is the only thing that has kept my sanity through this long winter. Oh, thank God. You so much. Linda from Richfield Springs.
It's a lot of pressure.
I say God bless you. And then we've heard from Joe in Ankrum, the 81 letters. Congress is ensuring the public will know the findings of the special counsel, even if Barr decides to bury it. Well, not necessarily, right? Because the Congress has the ability to subpoena. So does Mueller, of course. But Mueller may have stuff that the Congress will never have.
Well, what Nadler says on television is that they would subpoena Mueller and bring him in for testimony, but they might not be able to get the entire report.
And that goes to the Supreme Court of the United States, because up there we'll count the votes as to whether or not, you know, I mean, in the tapes in Nixon, it was a different group of Republicans, a better group of Republicans in my, you know, my estimation, and a different time. And they had the smoking gun. They had the bullet in the gun, and they had it.
They're going to need a smoking howitzer, I think, to convince a lot of people of something they already firmly disbelieve. You know.
Okay. And so Joe says, did I read that? Congress is ensuring that the public will know the findings of the special counsel, even if Barr decides to bury it. Well, so far, Mueller has been true to his word. He hasn't leaked anything. Hard to believe it, that will happen. Keith says, Congressman Nadler was on Maddow last night, and she said that all of the requested info was already given to other governmental investigations. He said he wasn't a law enforcement This wasn't a law enforcement investigation. It is an oversight investigation of these investigations. That's what it says. This is just the beginning. That's from Keith.
All right.
Julius, our good friend who writes us quite frequently and goes by two names. His formal name is Julius, but he always signs his letters Jules. Something deeply suspicious there. Investigation. Panel. Trump will leave it to Fox to find any dirt on Nadler at all, and that's from Jules. No, I don't think he will leave it to Fox. I think Fox will certainly cooperate, but I'm quite sure that they are turning over every single leaf they possibly can, and when they have it, the tweet will come from Trump. And now we heard from Bob. If Weisselberg refuses to testify, even if offered immunity, then all Nadler can do is to refer him to the Justice Department for contempt. But then the decision to pursue the case will fall to Trump's new AG. Any bets on what he'll do?
That's reminiscent of back in the 50s, you know, getting people before and demanding that they respond and taking them up on charges when they don't testify.
Ew.
And Cohen was a willing witness. It'll be interesting to see what happens when there are people that are not so excited to be testifying. Cohen was ready to talk. Mm. I don't know that Alan Weisselberg will be that ready to talk.
Well, you know, there's that point at which they put you up on that stand, and the night before you might be thinking, what else can they ask me about that I don't want them to know about? And you don't want to perjure yourself. Richard says, hi, panel. Any thoughts as to why Ty Cobb would come out with a statement praising Mueller? What reasoning could be behind it?
We were talking about that during the break, interestingly enough. Ty Cobb made the statement that he felt it was not a witch hunt, as the president has said over and over again, the Mueller investigation, and that he called Robert Mueller an American hero and a class act.
I think the way that history will view these people who are formerly allied with the president, who later come out on the side of Americans, it'll be an interesting roller coaster ride in their minds, if they're still alive and open to being interviewed about it. There's a lot of emotion involved in this, and then a little bit of self-interest. Probably flip those.
That's what we
call
it.
He has a career to maintain.
Right. And also, I mean, the interesting thing about Ty Cobb is he came in, he didn't last very long. I mean, he was only as part of the legal, like many of them, he was only a part of the legal team for less than a year. So.
Which is a good point, Joe, because maybe this is a little get-evenism here. He was badly treated by the president. This might be a way of sticking it to the president.
Or that he just didn't like what he saw and left.
Yeah, that's possible.
Is it appropriate for an attorney, who's been dismissed or pushed out to speak publicly? Well, he's not criticizing Trump. He's just saying he's not directly criticizing
Pretty
Trump.
Directly.
He's saying contradictory versions of who Mueller is than Trump is saying, I guess.
You can do that, right?
Well, I think he was also one of the lawyers who was overheard in open air at a restaurant, right? Talking about
saying something you can't
secret things.
Yeah. Okay, and then speaking of people we haven't heard about for a while, Jamie writes us, Hope Hicks. We will finally get to hear what Hope Hicks learned as the nice girl in the corner who no one noticed was hearing it all. I really think Donald failed to get her out of office long after he should have. We will find her out if her integrity was the reason he did it or if it was just self-preservation on her part. Bring on the ringmaster. Let the greatest show on earth begin. I happen to think that Jamie's right in that it was self-preservation on her part. Remember, she was a very young kid. She probably talked to her parents on the phone every night and say, I don't like what I'm seeing. And they were yelling what I would be yelling to my kid. Get out.
Now she's the executive vice president at Fox. She's the news director at Fox. I mean, I don't know. It still seems like she's...
Soft landing.
A lateral step.
No, soft landing.
She's still on Team Trump, I would say.
Yeah.
Well, I started reading, because it's very long, didn't finish this morning, Janet Mayer's new piece in this week's New Yorker, which I highly recommend, talking about Fox News and how it has basically become, state television. And it's intriguing, but they use the anecdote of when Trump went down after the government shutdown in December, went down to the border in Texas and had a whole big show about all the bad stuff that's coming over the border. And they say Sean Hannity was there up with all the officials while all the press was kept back, and Hope Hicks comes along and they give each other big hugs. And then you have the White House press secretary is the former head of Fox News. It's like one big thing.
Well, you know what Trump is going to do with this, right? He's going to wait. He's going to let it explode. And then he's going to say, and what exactly do you think Rachel Maddow and Morning Joe are all about? They're the anti-Trump news.
Yeah, it's the same thing. I think it's entertainment. Fox News and MSNBC and CNN are not news stations. They are entertainment stations.
It's not the same.
I don't think they're all the same. I think there's very – I mean, there's times even on Fox News where you got Chris Wallace who asks the right questions to people.
But also Sean Hannity and several other members of the Fox team have the president's ear.
Yeah.
They're appearing at his campaign events. Mm-hmm. That's different, isn't it?
No, it's the same
everything
thing.
Everything is different, Joe. Everything is different, but I think it's quite clear what the president's response is going to be on this.
I'm responding to JP's saying that like Rachel Maddow would be the same as Sean Hannity. I mean, I just that seems to be different to me.
One difference between MSNBC and Fox and. MSNBC can be sort of sickening when you see Joe Scarborough sort of get on his high horse. But today, he was not there, and neither was his wife, Brzezinski, Mika Brzezinski. But Willie Geist was running it, and they have great journalists, and they let them talk, and they let them finish sentences, and they come from reputable places.
So like Donnie Deutsch? Great journalist.
Donnie Deutsch, they have those. They have those wonks, but they bring on. They bring on, folks from the Washington Post, the New York Times.
They bring on like Hattie
Kay. Politico.
She's excellent. Yeah. It's. I think it's the same thing. MSNBC and Fox News. I'm sorry. Okay. Maybe you could disagree, but I think it's the same thing.
Let the listeners weigh in on that one.
Yes.
That's right. Okay. Jamie, we did that. Let the greatest show on earth begin letter. And then we heard from Pete, who said, Chicken McDonald. I noticed all the fast food was represented by Chick-fil-A. Yeah. No McDonald's or Burger King. Impeach now. Don't they refuse to insure their employees' health insurance? Peter. And what I love about Trump when he made that announcement is how many times he said, I paid for it. I paid for this. My personal account. Big deal. Okay, and then Michael says, word salad. I heard a friend or family member talking like the president at CPAC. I would take them to the emergency room right away. Why isn't this being taken more seriously? Mike and Rexford.
Yeah, the incoherent 2 hours and 18 minutes, was it?
Then? Yes.
Well, it was really something. I mean, I really thought it's from a mental health perspective, it was very dangerous. Because that guy has his finger on the button, and he was acting
unhinged.
But we've been conditioned for this since day one. It is the same thing in the debates.
Is a little bit more than usual? What we saw the other day.
Maybe, but that doesn't.
It was just sort of all at once, right?
Yeah, it was sort of like the greatest hits.
Right.
I think you mentioned that yesterday, Joe.
Yeah. They say that these rallies infuse him with new energy and embolden him to go back out and keep fighting, because he needs to draw from the energy of those crowds.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing. It's just the way he functions. I'm not convinced it's dangerous. Mm. We're all still here. It's It's been 2 years.
Well, it's always the first time.
It only takes once. But it's really more disturbing when you watch that, how little it really truly surprises and upsets you, just because we've come to accept that that's just the way he is.
And, you know, the Venezuela thing, which is always unfolding, very, very interesting. I know we got to go to a break, Joe, but very interesting in that the candidate, good old, what's his name, who ran against Maduro? Good old...
I'll never forget what's his name.
Yeah, good old... Yeah. So, well, he came back yesterday.
Starts with a G, I know that. That's all I know.
And he came back yesterday, and the U.S. ambassador and the other allied ambassadors were all there to meet him when he came back.
Guaido, right?
Juan Guaido.
Guaido. Yeah. And one gets the impression that there's Trump on the other end of the telephone saying all they have to do is lay one hand on him or any of our people over there, and that's the end.
The end. That'll be the beginning.
Well, that's the end of that. Then come the troops.
Let us take a break. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We welcome your thoughts, and we will return and talk about other things as well right after this short break.
She screams again.
So we're talking about, of course, what's going on in the House. Meanwhile, in the Senate, the White House is working to limit GOP defections in the Senate. Criticism ahead of vote to nullify Trump's emergency declaration. The White House told Senate Republicans on Monday to keep their powder dry ahead of a vote to nullify President Trump's declaration of a national emergency at the U.S.-Mexico border as the administration worked to limit defections on a measure rebuking the president. The message was delivered by Zach Parkinson, White House Deputy Director of Government Communications, in a meeting Monday with Senate Republican communications staffers. It came as Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell predicted that the resolution to overturn Trump's emergency declaration would pass in the Republican-led Senate, but not survive a veto. Over the weekend, Senator Rand Paul became the fourth Republican to announce he would support the disapproval resolution, ensuring its passage with unified Democratic support. But the White House is eager to contain further defections from members of Trump's party on a signature issue of building a wall along the southern border. The emergency declaration is aimed at getting additional money for border barriers after Congress refused to grant Trump's funding request.
You know, I've said it before, I'll say it again. The fact that there is a wall or not a wall really is immaterial to Trump. What is important to him is the issue of having the issue. So if they tell him, you know, we're not going to allow you to have a wall, he's going to say, those people out there left, those Democrats left you unprotected. And he'll repeat it over and over and over again. So McConnell, of course, is embarrassed by this. He can't rein those folks in. But surely there are some people who are sitting there in the Senate saying, I wonder what the history books are going to say about this, because we know that none of those Republican senators think this is a good idea.
That's right. I think we have a new goalpost. I can't believe we have Senator McConnell actually admitting defeat. When's the last time we've
seen him? He has to, right? He has to.
Yeah.
He has to, because he knows he's going to lose, so he has to get out in front of it.
Well, so the way that I read that, though, is that it's sort of like the dam is breaking. Because usually McConnell's role is to keep it. What is he going to? Who's he going to keep in line? Where's the? He doesn't have an anchor. So he gave them a lot of cover to come out and try to make it a veto-proof majority.
You think so? You think there's even a chance that there would be a veto-proof majority, that many Republicans?
I would love to believe that, but...
I mean, there are enough people on paper who have said that they have grave concerns. Now, whether we know how this works, that you say it and then you don't do it.
You have your cake and eat it, too.
Yeah, you send out a poll at home and see how that statement played at home.
Exactly.
And then you decide how you're going to vote.
Right.
So...
That's how that works.
So... but if you are, as you say, if the dam is starting to break and you're concerned about not only your job, but of how future Democratic presidents could possibly declare national emergencies.
And, for money.
And you're taking the long game. maybe, right?
Look, the Senate is going to go Democratic. I have no doubt about it.
In 2020.
In 2020, that's right. And so these guys don't have to be clairvoyant to know that and to know how that could be used against them.
I tend to agree with Sarah. I think this was a bold declaration by McConnell, and it gives all of these Republicans cover to go against the president on this. And you see respected Republican senator after respected Republican senator that are going to go against him. Rand Paul is certainly respected among his conference. And I think you could see a veto-proof majority on this. I think that it's the chips are falling away from the president on this.
Well, they say the vote will be on March 15th, the first one where they'll send it to the president, and then he has to veto it, and then it has to come back. And that's, you know, 3-4 weeks. Mueller might have come out by then, and then you begin to have the erosion of that support one by one. And it's plausible.
You've just planned our spring.
Yeah. It's springtime.
But McConnell, I think, is interesting, too, because he was saying yesterday, look, the reason I argued for this is because he said, obviously, without success. That's one reason I argued the Democratic presidents could declare emergencies. And I strongly said that the president should not take this route. That's interesting to me. I mean, obviously we knew that, but to come out and still say it, it seems as though you are giving your members somewhat of a, if not a green light, at least a pass to.
And telling Trump told you so.
Yeah.
Told you.
Yes. Yep. And Trump does not want to have a Senate battle without Mitch McConnell fighting forcefully on his side. He has shown no evidence of being able to win a battle like that. And with McConnell not fighting forcefully on Trump's side, I think Trump's in a very precarious position to have this be a veto-proof rebuke against him. Now, might the president end up liking that, going to Alan's point, saying that he just likes to have the issue of fighting over the wall? That's possible as well.
I mean, if we're lucky, he'll manipulate it into that situation, make sure that it's veto-proof so that he can come out and say, look at what they've done. I can't believe it, and then drum up the base for 2020.
Yeah, I think you're right, Sarah. I think that he'll very quickly, if that were to happen, turn it around, and he's clever. He'll make it a victory.
Well, he said to Sean Hannity last week, I really think that Republicans that vote against border security and the wall, I think, you know, I've been okay at predicting things, you know, I think they put themselves, sorry, I have to read it as quoted, I think they put themselves at great jeopardy. Whatever that means.
He always says the opposite of what's true. Somebody called him the great projectionist the other day. He always lays on everybody else what he's been doing all along. So he yells about rigged elections when he's the great rigger. And we know that. Anyway, Jeff from New Paltz writes, good morning, panel. These current investigations are clearly payback for the attacks on Hillary. This forevermore will be the new norm. Jeff from New Paltz.
Is it Benghazi?
I assume so, right?
Yeah.
And so Paul in Albany says, not NTUP. And then he says, in parenthesis, not the usual Paul. Mm. Oh, that's funny. Good morning, panel. With all the attention to the anti-immigrant hysteria from the right focused on the southwestern border, why haven't the media, progressive or right-wingers themselves noticed that the vast majority of those immigrants are mostly likely Christians, Catholics specifically, and point out the cognitive dissonance on the right? This big blind spot across the media and the failure of progressives to notice and use this as a wedge issue, please explain it. Thank you, Paul and Albany, not the usual Paul.
Well, the other big issue at the border is race. And race trumps religion every time, especially when you're talking about excluding people. We have very few religious exclusive categories until, the most recent Muslim ban. But historically, when it comes to immigration, the lines have all been drawn around race.
Complexion.
And you have black and brown women and children and young people presenting themselves at the border.
Stacy writes, and she always does this. I think this is Stacy does it. And her top line is, I agree with Alan. Now, there are those people who think if you say in your, you know, in your top line, I agree with Alan, that your letter will get read.
Well, evidently so.
Oh. Okay.
Go on.
Hi, panel. I think it's great that the House is taking its oversight responsibilities seriously. 81 requests is good. Should probably be more. What if DOJ does not release the Mueller's report? And that's from Stacy. Well, that's a very interesting point. Now, if you take this letter and you dissect it, because what if the DOJ does not release the Mueller's report? She's saying what I think we said earlier in the day, that this is very good that they're doing it because we don't. The onus will not be on Mueller to do all the work. Margaret says, Fox News. The fact that Fox News had the story Daniels story, Stormy Daniels story on October 2016, right after the Trump grabbed them tape and did not run it, shows everyone that Fox News, pardon me, is not a news operation. It is an extension of the Inquirer. This information will lower Fox's ratings. To which I say, want to bet? I'll bet it doesn't. I think the people who are watching Fox right now are the truly committed on the president's side of this of the line, and they love to go there and to have their opinions, you know, basically ratified. So I don't think so. Anyway.
I'm not sure it's news that a high-profile businessman, wannabe politician was involved with a porn star either. I'm not sure that's necessarily newsworthy.
Imagine if anybody else had done that. Any Democrat had done that, who was running for political office, and said, grab them by the you-know-what.
Oh, well, certainly. That was newsworthy. Yeah,
well, didn't NBC have that, and they didn't release it?
Correct.
It was the entertainment division, though. It wasn't the news division that had it. So the rules are different in that game, aren't they?
Well, I think the Today Show had it, didn't they? The Today Show had it, and then...
Did not use it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm unaware of that, but...
Well, NBC yeah. had it because it was...
Entertainment Tonight, right?
Well, it was...
Access Hollywood.
That's yeah. what it was.
Which was a Universal property, and Billy Bush and all that, and he was on the Today Show.
He was on the Today Show.
And they wanted to protect him, yes. and it got to be a whole thing.
But, yes.
Jamie writes, as the lobster slowly boils in the rising temperature pot, do you think it feels it is in danger?
As the lobster slowly boils.
These are the days of our lives.
That's right.
And I can't eat lobster anymore for exactly that reason. I think of that poor lobster. But then again, I have a hamburger every once in a while. You know what I mean?
I do.
Yeah.
All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We have Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, J.P. Miller, and Sarah Rogerson. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
You got me where you want me.
Good morning. Welcome back to The Roundtable and to our panel discussion. Tab Benoit performing the music that we're hearing on our buttons during the breaks, playing at the Iron Horse Music Hall in Northampton tomorrow night. And you can find out more at IHEG.com. IHEG.com. Welcome back to The Roundtable and to the panel. Alan Chartok is here, Mike Spain, J.P. Miller, and Sarah Rogerson. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Alan has a few, and then we'll move on to other stuff.
Just a few, Joe. Tom says, Joe is right about Fox. Fox News is substantially different than CNN and MSNBC for the very reason Joe mentioned. Fox personalities like Hannity and Pirro, among others, have a direct line to the president. There isn't anything like that at CNN or MSNBC. I mean, whose ear does Chris Cuomo have? Maxine Waters? Is Chris Matthews texting Nancy Pelosi? The answer is no, and the difference matters, and that's Tom. I did hear this discussed yesterday in which Ben Bradley, don't you remember him? Don't you know of the Washington Post
fame,
was
yeah.
pretty close to the president of the United States.
He and JFK were buddies, and they hung out, and he wrote a book about it, reflections of his life with, you know, his friendship with JFK.
I'm very surprised to see people writing letters, to tell you the truth, that are defensive about MSNBC. Our audience would never do that. Sarcasm! Okay, here we go. Neil says, Senate vote. Please, people, even if the Senate votes to override a presidential veto, the House never will. What? Do you think that the Senate is going to be more likely to override a presidential veto than the House will? No, the House is more likely to. And I agree with the letter writer, Neil, because I think they haven't got enough votes to do it even there.
You don't think there's enough votes in the House of Representatives to override the veto?
No.
No. To do the math.
Certainly not on that Oversight Committee. Holy moly. Hmm. They're all...
Well, that's all I have, Joe, so we can proceed with the other stuff.
Fine. Fantastic. Let's go to family migrations. Record number of... Washington Post. Don't you know that I'm a subscriber? Stop making me log in again. I don't mind logging in. I do mind having to determine where the stop signs and the traffic lights are.
That's tough.
That's annoying.
Yeah.
And you don't ever know whether you count the wires and the pole. And then it seems that either way I do it, it comes out wrong.
I get very cerebral about those things.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Is that a bus? I don't know. Is that a storefront? I can't tell. Yeah. I don't know. Is it a storefront?
Some of those storefronts are ambiguous.
Well, yes, yeah. very much so.
They put things in there that they make you want to look, or it looks like a storefront, darn it, but maybe it's not. Maybe it's a shoebox.
What am I missing here? I have no idea what you people are talking
when,
about.
When you log into certain websites, it has a secondary verification where you have to look at pictures and then prove
you're
not
a robot.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Interesting.
Which the robots can probably figure out, but we can't.
The robots
exactly. Much better than we are about that. I agree. So we look at this story. It's from El Paso, Texas. A record number of families and the cold reality at the border. And this is a story looking at just how many people we have at the border and illegal crossings are expected to surge again.
It's not a surge. This happens every time it gets warm.
Okay,
right?
but the number goes up, right?
Yeah, then it increases in a noticeable way.
Okay,
cyclically, we're still historically at record low numbers of people. I mean, this is sort of a play on semantics, right? We might have record high numbers of whole families presenting themselves, but that's not a record number of people who have been presenting themselves at the border over time. If you look back over the last 50 years, we're actually at a low point in migration. And I do appreciate the journalism on the border. I think it's really important that people understand the complexity of the border, the dynamics of the border, the fact that the border is not just a line that people cross. It's a community. It's a zone. But I'm just getting a little tired of language around surges, because if you look at it over time, we don't have record numbers of people at our border. We do have record numbers of people waiting to cross because they've locked down lawful ports of entry. And that's new and different. So, and every time you have a group of people present themselves at a different port of entry, then the president says, it's a swarm. We're breaking records. Look at all these people. It's crazy. We have to shut it down. And then they go to the next lawful port of entry because that's what they're supposed to do.
Are you saying that we don't need our U.S. military forces along the border? It's unnecessary?
Absolutely.
We heard from Richard, who says, panel, I hope the Mueller report is released before global climate change floods the whole planet and civilization comes to an end.
Hmm. Well, just to get back to the border story.
Oh, yeah, I'm so sorry.
It's a tragic.
Because we're not talking about that anymore.
It's a tragic story. It shows the human frailties, and it demonstrates how desperate these people are. You know, I was thinking of a story earlier, Sarah, that the New York Times did over the weekend, that although Mexico will not pay for the Great Wall, and they've made it pretty clear, the new president and the new administration in Mexico is cooperating tacitly with the Trump administration. They're pushing people back, and they're discouraging them in many ways, and they're disrupting their efforts to come to the U.S. border on the Mexico side, and kind of playing along. It is an awful, awful experience. I can't even describe it when you read these stories about what it must be like for these people to come in and then be ripped apart from their kids and shipped all over.
Yep.
Tell us about the term family migration, what that means.
So our immigration system was built on the idea of family unity. People forget about that, but that's what that was one of the main intents of our original immigration laws, to keep families together. And so the idea was we set up these systems in order to make sure I mean, it used to be very patriarchal, right? Like you, a single woman of a certain age would not be able to enter the country without a male relative accompanying her. And so we started focusing on these issues of what makes sense in terms of people coming into our country and what rules are we going to set up around that. There are a number of family-based preference categories that are baked into our immigration laws. And this is important. This is what Donald Trump calls chain migration, but that his wife's family just completed the process of doing recently, which is if you have a United States citizen son or daughter, or if you have if a United States citizen has relatives abroad that they want to follow to join them in the United States, there's a process to do that. There are incredible wait times for countries, certain countries, India, for example, the Philippines. It's like 17 years or something of a wait time. But there is
to get into the Philippines. People are waiting
to get into the United States. Oh. If you're from
Australia, though, it's overnight.
Yeah. Norway tomorrow.
Something
so
about complexion there.
So that's so the family-based migration is part of our of the contemplation of our immigration laws at this point. It was only very recently that we started with ability-based categories, entrepreneurial categories, work-based visas. All that stuff is post-family unity type immigration. So what we're talking about here are families presenting themselves for seeking asylum. They don't have someone in the United States who could petition for them in all likelihood. And they are fleeing their country. This would be more properly categorized as humanitarian-based migration. Mm-hmm. It's just that people are coming together as opposed to sending their children, which happened, you'll remember, in 2008, 2009 through 2012, where you had caravans of unaccompanied children coming to the United States. Here we have entire family units presenting themselves because they don't want to split up the family unit in order to seek safety for one. So It's the situation in these countries that are the push factors are changing such that, and maybe the persecutors are getting a lot smarter, right? They don't just threaten the male, you know, head of household. They threaten the male head of household and say, if you don't do what we tell you to do, we're going to kill your entire family. So then the whole family flees. So it's case by case. There are the stories vary. Literally, family by family, the situations are different. And I've read them, hundreds of them, 350 of them, to be precise, just last summer in the Albany County Jail, stories of why people fled their country to come here. Pages and pages and pages of horrific details. So we can't lump them all together. And really, I keep saying this, what's more important on the border, instead of the military, are judges, asylum officers, beef up the processes that we have baked into the system in order to process what are actually reasonable numbers of individuals seeking safety in the United States, especially since our refugee numbers are at record lows, like historic lows of the numbers of refugees that we have decided that we'll accept. Trump lowered that beyond the lowest point in history.
Sarah, you got a letter from Ken in Stone Ridge, who says, "Hi, in her comments about the actions people could take through their churches to protest the treatment of migrants on the Mexican border, Sarah said that people of faith had an obligation to act, especially Christians. Why? Do Christians have a higher moral obligation or sensitivity than non-Christians? I found it disturbing to hear people's moral obligation of awareness being based on their religion. Thank you.
That statement was taken out of context. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
No, it wasn't. I do believe that Christians, not just Christians, people of faith, are commanded in their holy books to keep to watch out for people in poverty, to look for those who are being persecuted. It's not just a Christian tradition. That's where I misspoke. I was myopic in my statement. It's all people of faith. Every single major religious text tells us that we should be paying attention to these situations.
But I do understand, not to be your lawyer, because you don't need one.
You are one. I can't represent myself.
I do understand you're not a lawyer.
That when you speak to your own group, it has less condescension. Than if you were talking to, you know, if Sarah said, okay, all you Jews out there need to be better about this, it would be very different than if you're talking to your own Christian community. Am I wrong about that?
I don't know. I think that that's an interesting take. I think when it comes to morality, I feel more comfortable speaking from the Christian tradition just because that's what I know. But for maybe I'm misunderstanding the letter, but religion and morality are intertwined in ways that are, you know, that form the basis of most religious traditions.
But when we were talking about this yesterday, the context of the conversation was about the religious right, number one, right?
Mm-hmm.
And also was about, which you labeled, that many of the people coming across on the border and their religious principles.
Mm-hmm.
And if you put those two together, then that would make more sense.
Well, but I've represented folks who are Muslim. I've represented folks who identify as Jewish. I've represented, you know, I don't think we need to self-select. In this time, when we're talking about what's right and what's wrong, what we need to do is galvanize people around what's right and what's wrong, not how they came to that conclusion. And I guess my point is that you don't need to look very far in the Bible, so we'll go back to the Christian faith, to see moral imperatives from the mouth of Jesus Christ himself about what the church and what people of faith are supposed to do in these situations in the real world. And he lived by example, so follow it. I'm now a radio evangelist.
I like it.
Yeah, it's good. Let's move on to, we started with this, so we'll probably end with it, which is what's going on in Canada and Justin Trudeau. Yesterday, the second Trudeau minister resigned as the crisis in Canada and the political crisis there is swelling. There was an NPR report this morning about this with Brian Mann, and I thought it was interesting because one of the things that came out of that was just how swift all of this has been in a very, very short period of time. So another minister in the cabinet of Justin Trudeau of Canada quit in protest on Monday over accusations that he and his aides tried to influence a criminal case against a multinational Canadian company accused of bribing the Libyan government. The unexpected resignation, who led the Treasury Board, inflames a growing political crisis that has already cost Mr. Trudeau his former justice minister and his top aide.
And that former justice minister was apparently the only Indigenous member of his cabinet that was left, which has been one of the other major embarrassments in his tenure.
Was that the Attorney General? Because I know the Attorney General resigned.
I think it was the Justice Minister.
Yeah, well, I saw something.
Well, the simple explanation of all this is government, high-level government officials in Canada have higher standards than ours do here.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, yes and no. I mean, yes and no. I mean, I think it's extraordinary that he's in this kind of trouble. You know, he was bulletproof, as everybody knows. He was extremely popular there. And yet his explanation falls short of something you could have confidence in. I hate to say that because, you know, I've been a big fan. But I think he's in trouble.
It reminds me of Trump, and I would never compare Trudeau to Trump, but here I am in a room with Comey saying, you know,
yeah, exactly.
We really want this to go away. This
exactly.
would be politically bad for me. And
in fairness, and this only mitigates it slightly, I do acknowledge. But in fairness, this is a major employer, and that was the perspective that he was taking, that he felt there were legitimate legal alternatives to direct prosecution that would also preserve the economic benefits of having this company there. And once I guess that's a slippery slope, but it's...
No, like, you're right. I get that. But and that's fine if that was the message for the first two meetings. That's a legitimate purpose. But he had like 10,
yeah.
11.
After you.
Yeah,
and as Pete sang, oh, when will they ever learn? Because it's very familiar.
So terrifying. 7 months from now is the election. So question number one, does he salvage his reputation to survive the election? Two, does he make it to the election?
Right. In Canada, under their form of government, he could be pushed out of office, basically, if he loses enough support in the parliament, right?
Mm-hmm.
It'll be interesting to watch. You know, we everybody has such great affection for him, especially when Trump was first elected and he was so and the whole immigration thing kind of blew up. He just came across as so reasonable and so unoffensive and so polite but maybe that, you know, we're seeing through that now.
Well, there's always been an undercurrent of critique of Trudeau, given his father's politics, that they were a little too close to big money. They were a little, you know, and that's why it's just kind of sad and maybe ironic that it's a big money, big oil group that ultimately ends up, hopefully not, because they do, leadership is about more than one, you know, he doesn't have a pattern and practice of this sort of behavior,
as far as we know about.
Right. But he does have a very visible, and I'm sure this is very intentional, pattern and practice of you know, lifting up minority groups, of being supportive of LGBTQ rights. So it'll be a test of his legacy. It'll be a test of whether the people love him and if they love him enough to forgive him.
And we close with this. Hillary Clinton made it official last night. She is not running for president.
Well, I didn't have any idea that she was, but one of the things that I'm thinking of here is that she steps aside and Biden comes in to fill the void. I mean, I think this is almost the way that they work it.
I don't think Biden runs, but it's you know, I think
got $5.
Hillary, yeah, I'll bet you $5.
Heard it here, folks.
I think Hillary did herself a favor. I thought it was cool that she also
what
did it
wagering
not
on the show.
she also didn't do it on some big national news program. She did it on a local Westchester station, which I thought was cool, and gave a local reporter the big scoop. And so I thought she did a really classy job in saying that she wasn't going to do it.
The field is already pretty crowded.
Yeah, a lot of people in the field. When do you think we hear about Biden one way or the other?
He said a couple more weeks. He was really close to it, talking to his family, and he was close to making a decision. Bloomberg is supposed to make a decision in 2.5 weeks.
He's chicken.
And, you know, and then we're still waiting to hear from the governor of Montana and the governor of Washington State and the governor of New York.
Boy, the governor of New York yesterday when Alan was talking to him certainly sounded that if Biden was out, he was in.
Pretty much, Alan. What do you think?
No, I think he's showing signs. Buffalo, New York, called me up this morning, WBEN, to talk about his remarks and whether I thought he was going to run for president. And I said, well, if you know, the Cuomos both had the same thing. They needed to be anointed. That's not the way it works. You got to put yourself in. You got to ask for people's votes, and then you can win.
Well, he also said, I thought very credibly, that he was the most accomplished progressive in the country. No other candidate can claim his record of accomplishment.
Sounds
in the
like
country.
A guy who's running for president,
it
right?
Sure
sounds
does.
Like
it, yeah. All right, we're out of time. My thanks to everybody, and we'll be back after this short break.